The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joanna LaForgia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting content from the April 2025 issue of Southern Living Magazine. This week, we will finish the story we began last week. It was an essay from Rick Bragg, and it was entitled Fried Chicken, A Love Story. And then we'll move on to The Grumpy Gardener. And if we have time, we might make it to Ivy's Kitchen today. Otherwise, next episode. All right? Are we ready? Okay. This is continuing. Oops, excuse me. This is, again, Southern Living, the South's Bet. This is the cover. It's a blue hue, and it's got a photo of the town of Duck on the Outer Banks, which is a peninsula extending into the blue ocean. There's an ocean blue tone to this cover. And it says, Southern Living, the South's best, vacation of the year, restaurant of the year, barbecue joints, cities, classic hotels, cruises, resorts, seafood dives, and more. And then it says, 50 best beach towns, the strange delight of pear salad, Aaron and Ben Napier's gorgeous greenhouse, and The Only Way to Make Fried Chicken by Rick Bragg. And that's where we pick up from our last episode, listeners. We're going to just repeat a bit of what we read last week just to get us situated. When I was a boy, I believed that the greatest day in American history was June 14th. It was my grandma's birthday, and the best cooks in the whole world, her daughters, grandchildren, and other kin, all descended upon the little house on Roy Webb Road with tinfoil-covered mountains of fried chicken. I believed, stupidly, that it would never run out. But if you live long enough, everything does. I know some old men sit around and think about their grandchildren or good dogs or that 1969 Firebird that looked fast even parked in the yard. They wonder what happened to their class ring after that girl, now what was her name, threw it flittering and bouncing across the parking lot of the TGNY. But me, I think about the great chicken I have known. Thelma Grundy's soul food spot in downtown Atlanta was torn down to make Centennial Olympic Park. Celestine Dunbar's place on Ferret Street in New Orleans was drowned by Hurricane Katrina. The Village Inn in Jacksonville, Alabama, closed its doors years ago. Friar Tuck's in Birmingham has been gone for decades. It opened at 11 a.m. My friend Greg and I were there every day at 10:59. I don't know how many shiny new places. I think some things belong to the past, and if we are lucky, they endure. I took a job in New York when I was still a young man. My mother told me I would starve, but she didn't know about Sylvia Woods. Twice a week, I'd take a cab to Harlem and walk into Sylvia's restaurant. And excuse me, listeners, but that's still there today. Okay, back to our essay. I'd take a cab to Harlem and walk into Sylvia's restaurant, which seemed like it had been hauled up there from home on a flatbed truck. They'd have red velvet and caramel cakes under glass and collards, cabbage, and smoked turkey wings and dressing. But mostly there'd be good chicken with hot cornbread, green beans, and macaroni and cheese. It endures. While Mae Seton lived to be 99, and oh, excuse me, listeners, it's Willie. Willie Mae Seton lived to be 99, and her Willie Mae Scotch House carries on not far from New Orleans. Treme neighborhood. Her great-granddaughter keeps its memory and menu alive. Gus's world-famous fried chicken spread from coast to coast. I restored my soul at locations in Memphis and Birmingham. The last meal I ate with my brother Sam, the greatest man I've ever known, was there. Woods picked beans on a South Carolina farm before she moved to New York and began cooking some of the best soul food in the city. Seton drove a taxi, cut hair, and ran a bar prior to opening a restaurant that eventually won a James Beard America's Classics Award. And her chicken always tasted like where it started. Once a week, when I was little, my mother would shove back the couch in my grandma's house to pick up the bones I'd tossed there and tell me not to ever do it again. I heard decades later that my kin were moving things around in the old house and found a single petrified chicken bone. She must have missed one. I would have liked to have had it so I could put it in the drawer where I keep my brother Sam's pocket knife and the mismatched dice my daddy willed me when he died, and my grandfather's fishing license from 1956. I suppose you never know what people will treasure. And listeners, that's the end of the story, but Rick Bragg ends here, has a recipe here for Margaret Bragg's fried chicken. Here's Grandma's fried chicken recipe. It's the active time for this recipe is 35 minutes, and it takes a total of 45 minutes to prepare. It serves four, and here are our ingredients. 1 4-pound whole frying chicken, 1 tablespoon of kosher salt, 1 teaspoon of black pepper, 2 cups of all-purpose flour, and 1 or 2 pounds of lard for frying, enough to form at least a 1-inch pool in the skillet. And here are our 4 steps. 1. Cut the chicken into 8 pieces, 2 each of breasts, thighs, wings, and drumsticks, being sure to save the liver, gizzards, back, neck, or anything else, even if you are not sure what it is. Salt and pepper all the pieces lightly. Using your hands, dust the damp pieces, top, bottom, and sides, as completely as you can with flour. Do not dredge in egg wash, etc. The point is to have a light, barely there crust. Cover and set aside. Step 2. In a large cast iron skillet or tall-sided cast iron chicken fryer or Dutch oven, heat the lard over medium-high until it liquefies, but do not turn the heat so high that it begins to smoke. Gently, carefully add the chicken pieces. Let them crisp for a moment and then reduce the heat to medium. Do not worry about turning the chicken before you reduce the heat. Step 3. Over medium heat, cook the chicken between 20 and 25 minutes, turning it 4 times. I am not sure what the science of this is. I guess it's just because my mother says so. And gizzards, liver, and other pieces about halfway through the process. Some people cook livers for only a few minutes, but my mother has such a fear of undercooked poultry, it's a cultural thing, that she crisps the organ meats a little more than necessary. In between gyrations, cover the skillet with a lid. Again, be careful because steam can build up in just a few minutes. If you don't know whether your chicken is done, remove a thigh, cut into it, and look, being careful not to burn yourself or burn up the rest of the chicken. You can stick a meat thermometer into it if you have one and know how to use it. But in this, you are on your own. We have never used one. And the last step, step four, let the chicken cool at least 10 minutes. The thighs retain heat, and I've seen them smoke when I've taken a bite, even after 10 minutes. And just a little side note here for us. It says, fried and true, my mother's unconventional rules for perfect chicken. And there are two of them here, listeners. One is, lean into the lard. You may be unable to bring yourself to fry your chicken in lard. It is not a sin to feel this way. My mother often fries hers using cooking oil. Some go with peanut oil. Others swear by Crisco. Very smart people will go on and on talking about burn ratios and such. I do not associate with them. Neither does my mother. She still uses lard a third of the time for the sake of history. And the next and last is crowd the skillet. Some cooks fry only a few pieces at a time to make sure the chicken crisps correctly, and they turn it only once. But my people do crowd the skillet. I make sure there's just enough space, my mother explained. It'll taste better having it all cooked together. White and dark meat, the liver, the bony pieces. She puts the bigger ones in the middle of the skillet and places the wings on the outside. And there we have it, with the exception of a full-page photo on the opposite page here of this golden fried chicken. It is all golden, and the photo shows the real texture of this chicken. You can almost feel it. You can almost taste it. It's even got some crispy flakes of its coating that have spilled over to the side on a napkin that lines this white plate. And that's a full page. And you can see there are breasts, wings, and drumsticks and thighs here. And the caption is, Margaret Bragg's Fried Chicken. And now we move on to our Grumpy Gardener. The Grumpy Gardener, which begins, as always, with about a quarter page size cartoon or drawing. It's a cartoon, actually. And it's a picture of two people in a garage or a barn. It's some wooden structure that is open onto a background field of green hills with a blue sky above it. And in the center of these green hills is nestled what appears to be a barn and a silo and two green trees. It could be evergreen trees or deciduous. They're kind of there in the background. And in the foreground, inside this structure, which again is some kind of a garage or tool shed or something, it's got coffee brown wooden floor and matching walls or doors that have been slid open. And there is a woman and a man. And the woman is saying something to the man. And she has gray hair. She has a yellow top and sky blue trousers on and brown shoes. She has one hand on her hip and the other is extended, holding a pair of bike pedals. The man is holding a bicycle and he is looking at her. They're looking at each other, of course. The man is wearing glasses, has brown hair, red top, yellow shorts, and green shoes. And he has one hand on the bicycle. They're both in profile, looking at each other. He has one hand on the bicycle, and the other hand is out holding a flower, which has three red petals left. The petals have been ripped off it, and a yellow center. And the bicycle has red flower petals in its spokes and all around the bars as well, and they're spilled onto the floor. And in the caption, there is a quote, and the woman is saying, "I said Daniel's bike needed new pedals, you twit." And the title on the top of the cartoon says, "Why Master Gardeners Aren't So Handy Around the House." So he put pedals, P-E-T-A-L-S, on the bike when it was P-E-D-A-L-S that it needed. Okay, here we go with our Grumpy Gardener by Steve Bender. "Dear Grumpy, since my husband became a master gardener, he's been useless around the house. He can't fix a light bulb, squash a spider, or lift a basket of laundry. All he does is read about plants, talk about plants, prune plants, and buy more plants. I hate his stupid plants. Any advice? Jessica." And Grumpy's answer? "First of all, Jessica, there are no stupid plants, just misunderstood ones. Second, you just have to accept that the title Master Gardener is so prestigious that those awarded it often add it to their office doors, business cards, and letterheads, LinkedIn profiles, and headstones. Getting him to change his ways may involve bringing in the big guns. Announce that henceforth, every night, will be a Hallmark movie marathon. If that doesn't work, he is lost. Time to move on." And the next letter. "Rotten apples. I live in North Carolina and have lots of apple trees. They look great in spring. But as the months progress, the leaves fall off and the trees look terrible, even though they still bear fruit. My spouse wants to cut them down. I'd like to save them. Is there something we can spray that won't contaminate the nearby creek? Signed, Carl." And Grumpy says, "Many fungal diseases affect the foliage and fruit of apples. The best preventive measure is planting disease-resistant options like Priscilla, Liberty, Freedom, and Red Free. But it's too late for that here. So I recommend you treat your trees every 10 to 14 days after they finish blooming with neem oil." And listeners, that is spelled N-E-E-M as in Mary. "Neem oil, according to label directions. It's a natural fungicide that helps control common apple diseases such as powdery mildew, apple scab, and rust. Spraying your trees with dormant oil in the winter will also help, as will picking up all rotten fruit on the ground and throwing it out with the trash. Keep in mind that fish are very sensitive to both natural and synthetic pesticides, so don't apply those near the water." The next is Bermuda grass invasion. "I live in North Louisiana, and my backyard zoysia grass," that's spelled Z-O-Y-S-I-A, "my backyard zoysia grass is being taken over by Bermuda. Is there a way to get rid of it without killing the zoysia? Signed, Liz." "Unfortunately, there is no herbicide labeled for home use that safely eliminates Bermuda from zoysia. The best way to control Bermuda is to thicken up your zoysia through proper fertilization so it crowds out the Bermuda. Fertilize in spring after the grass greens up, and then again in late June or early July. Mow at 1.5 inches high." The next is awful air fruit. "We're all out of hope. We live in Biloxi, Mississippi, and have a lot of satsumas." I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, listeners. Let me spell it in case I'm not. It's S-A-T. S as in Sam, U, M as in Mary, A-S. "We have a lot of satsumas we call air fruit. The rinds are thick, and the flesh is airy and tasteless. What are we doing wrong? Signed, Michelle. Never again remind me of Air Supply, that Australian band from the 70s, or their treacly single, All Out of Love. Now that I've stopped retching, back to your question. The satsumas, one of the most cold-hardy types of citrus, are likely crummy due to a lack of phosphorus and nitrogen in the soil. Try feeding them in spring with a citrus fertilizer according to label directions. And our last note to Grumpy is, big no to hostas. We have a Japanese maple in a shady 3-by-6-foot bed. We used to have mondo grass there too, but we ignored it, and it died. We thought about planting hostas in place of the mondo grass, but a landscaper said the maple would suck the nutrients from the soil so the hostas wouldn't live long. Would they have a chance? Signed, Carter. I agree with the landscaper. That's a small bed for a tree. Soon the maple's roots will fill it, and hostas don't like root competition. Replant the mondo grass as a shallow-rooted evergreen ground cover beneath the tree, and this time, give it a little love. And here is Grumpy's Gripe of the Month. When we bought our house decades ago, flowering dogwoods, Cornus florida, filled the woods behind it with blossoms every spring. No more. One by one, all of those dogwoods died, victims of drought, heat, and disease. So what changed? The climate. Spring begins earlier, fall lasts longer, and summer is hotter. I conclude that the resulting stress makes trees weaker and more disease-prone, just like it does to people. We can only hope that genetically resilient dogwoods better suited to the new world order will come along. Until then, baby the ones that you still have, and don't forget to take pictures before the worst happens. And, listeners, this is accompanied by this little section that we just heard, is accompanied by a cartoon of the Grumpy Gardener, Steve Bender. Was that his name? Steve Bender? Yes, Steve Bender. And he is, I'm assuming it's him, brown hair, glasses, blue shirt, tan trousers, and he is sitting on a chair before an upside-down wheelbarrow, which is red, and it is serving as a desk for him. He has a typewriter upon the upside-down wheelbarrow, and he is typing upon it. And then there's a little yellow flower with a smile on her face and a long green leaf that's serving as one arm, two green leaves, a short one serving as an arm to hold down the paper and the typewriter. The other one is a long green leaf that is an arm around Steve's neck and a hand on his other shoulder, on his far shoulder. Okay. And one more note by Steve Bender. Solarscape XL Pink Jewel Impatience. This is Know Your Plants. Brace for impact. This sun-loving annual steals the show from spring until frost. Every year I try out new plants. I praise the ones that perform and banish those that don't. Here's the latest one to gain my favor. Solarscape XL Pink Jewel Impatience, a 2024 All-America Selections winner. Like Sun Patience, the Solarscape XL series loves bright light, but also thrives in part sun. Solarscape XL Pink Jewel features huge magenta pink blossoms more than 2 inches across the top, mounds of disease-free foliage reaching 12 to 15 inches tall and 18 to 20 inches wide. Grow it in a solid border or a container. Faded flowers are self-cleaning, no deadheading required. Look for this beauty in garden centers this spring. Signed, Steve Bender. And there's a photo of it, of this plant, listeners, right here. And it's just as was described. These pink, hot pink or magenta flowers crowded above some dark green foliage that frames the group of flowers. And then we have a circle profile close-up of one of the flowers that's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, about 9 petals all around it and a tiny bead in the middle. And that's our grumpy gardener. We have a little more time left, so we can go on to just a bit of Ivy's Kitchen, maybe? Let's see. Ah, yes, this is our cover story of the strange delight of pear salad in Ivy's Kitchen. It wouldn't be Easter without this old-school recipe by Ivy Odom. In the South, we use the term salad quite liberally. If you ever attended a potluck with folding tables laden with cut crystal platters bearing mysterious fruit-studded fluffs or shiny gelatin-set delights, quote-unquote, I can see how these concoctions might cause you to raise an eyebrow. But as a Southerner, I know to expect far more than lettuce when salad is on the menu. Of all the traditional dishes from the luncheons, get-togethers, and picnics of my childhood, there's one that reigns supreme. The recipe is simple. Open a can of pear halves. There's no place for fresh here. Set them on your serving piece of choice. In my family, this means a deviled egg plate. Dollop each with a hefty glob of mayonnaise. Don't be shy. And top with a generous sprinkle of shredded cheddar cheese. Et voila, pear salad. Some folks serve it on a bed of butter lettuce or with a maraschino cherry on top. But for my Nana, those frilly additions were unnecessary. Her mother never added those garnishes, so neither did she. I can't remember a meal at Nana's house where there wasn't pear salad on the table. And I know that if I were to go into my mama's pantry right now, I'd find a can or two of pears, just in case we need an extra side, quote unquote. And listeners, we've run out of time for today's episode of Southern Living. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll listen next time. I'm Joanna LaForgia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And listeners, I will add here that if you do not see it under Southern Living, then our volunteer tech team hasn't had a chance to change the name yet, so you will see it under Triangle Bulletin Board, under Specials and then Triangle Bulletin Board. All right. If you have any comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. Please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long till next time.